Okay.
Hi. Anyway, thank you for inviting me here. So it's 11 p.m. at home, so it is bedtime. So this is going to be a gentle talk, because I have to be able to understand it. And so I thought, so the goal is sort of to explain a number of sort of very recent concepts in Groen-Witten theory, and I want you to all feel comfortable with old-fashioned Groen-Witten theory before we move on and talk about Groen-Witten theory. So this is when I write one here, I don't mean this is the first talk, I just mean this is the first part of the sequence of talks. So I'm going to work in the algebraic geometric context. You could do everything I'm talking about in the context of symplectic manifolds, and the theory ends up looking somewhat different, but gives in theory the same answer. So I'm going to fix here X the variety. At the moment, I won't assume anything about it. It may not be compact. It might not be non-singular. It might be singular. And then I can define the notion of a stable map, or a stable n-pointed map of genus G, with target X, is going to look pretty complicated, but it's actually quite simple. So it's a diagram like this. Here X is our target space. These are all schemes. C over W is a family of curves, about which I will say a little bit more. And then we have a bunch of sections, sigma 1, so x1 through xn sections. This will be F, and let's call this map pi. Okay, so where this is,
first of all, pi is a fat family of projective nodal curves. So, I mean, for those of you who are in symplectic geometers and don't like algebraic geometric terms like flat families, just think for the moment that W is a point and just have a curve, a single curve. But it is allowed to be a singular curve. It can be nodal in a sense that it can look something like that, where you just have two, at each singular point, you have two branches. Cross. Okay. So, anyway, every fiber of this family, C to W, should look like that. Of course, they need not have those. They might be non-singular. So, X1 through XN are sections. We're going to assume that they're disjoint. And also disjoint from the nodal locus. So one way to think about that is we just have, so for over each point in W, we have a curve, and on that curve we have a number of points. And so on. They should be distinct points. These were saying that these are disjoint sections, and you're not allowed to use one of the nodal points as a marked point. So that's the second condition. And then the third condition is where the word stable comes in. is that these maps should not have too many automorphisms. And so for, if you have a geometric point of equal R and W, the fiber, so just think again, if you're not out of that job, just think, well, you just take one curve in the family, parameterized by point W in the base, the fiber. W along with the marked points. This map has only a finite number of automorphisms. Where an automorphism of CW bar is an automorphism F it first of all fixes the marked points at 5xi is equal to xi and F composed of 5 F. And this has a very simple description in terms of the geometry. What's going on here? This holds if and only if. This is all. This holds if and only if. Every irreducible component of the curve contracted by the map, so on which the map is constant. Is either is 0 with at least 3 special points. So what do I mean by special point? I mean either a marked point or a node. And let me point out just to, if I took this compound, irreducible compound here, I actually should normalize it and count this self node as 2 points. So this has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 special points. Okay, so we should either have a genus 0 compound with at least 3 special points, genus 1 with at least 1 special point, or genus greater than the 2 with no. And that's just because an irreducible compound, a curve of genus greater than 2, has automatically finite automorphisms. A curve of genus 0 will have an infinite automorphism group unless we're fixing at least 3 points. Okay, so that's what a stable map is. What are Gromov-Witt invariants? The Gromov-Witt invariants are supposed to be things that count stable maps. With certain conditions. So the thing that you usually do after you write down this long definition is you define the model of space. So fix, say, genus G and N and the class beta, the second homology. And then we define NGN of X beta. Sometimes people like to put a bar there to indicate that it's going to be involve all these singular gadgets too. Is the moduli space of stable maps, of stable n-pointed maps. Genus G with the push forward of the fundamental class of the curve being beta. same class as where specific visual homology class curve represents. Okay, so obviously you have to prove that this is a moduli space in some reasonable sense. So there's a bunch of statements you can make.
Well, I think we forgot to discuss the arithmetic genus of these.
Yeah, I should have put this. This should be probably the right place to put it. So each fiber should be a curve in the GSG. If I'm being more careful, I should probably say connected. H1 of OC should be G. Okay, so we have a sequence of statements. So here's some facts from the prehistory of Witten theory. And I can mention various names here. Kansevich was the one who actually proposed looking at these stable maps. And then part of what I'm going to tell you now is Hecke and so the first thing is we need to know in what sense this moduli space exists. So M bar N X beta is a Lie Mumford stack. If you have an idea what a stack is, don't worry. This is like a scheme, but maybe a finite portion of the scheme locally. And remember the fact that and that's just because it really just arises from the fact that while we're insisting that we only have a finite number of automorphisms, we can't always get rid of automorphisms entirely. If the curves have no automorphisms, then the scheme. But the stacking structure keeps track of the fact that the curves have no. So that's the first thing. We can't really say much more unless we impose some hypotheses on X. So, for example, if X is projective, then NGN X beta is projective. So we then have. If in addition X is non-singular, and this is really the most important feature of this moduli space, a basic fact of deformation theory. These things are classifying some objects. And deformation theory is a technique that allows you to say locally what the moduli space for these objects looks like. It tells you, for example, what the tangent space to the moduli space should be. And it puts them down on a number of equations for how much bigger the tangent space is than the actual dimension of the moduli space. So in general, there's an expected dimension. Deformation theory, whatever you have a moduli problem, you can say what the expected dimension is. And unfortunately, as I'm going to show you, the expected dimension is often not equal to the actual dimension. But we would like to be able to treat this as if this is a space of the correct dimension. And there is some general machinery about which I'm going to say very little in these talks. there is a class, something called the virtual fundamental class. With our right is M, G, and X data. Vert. What is this? This will be a homology class in the of X, but M, G, and X data. And maybe you play it safe. I better do rational coefficients because we're doing the stack. Again, don't get too anxious about the fact that this is a stack. Just pretend that it's a nice topological space. So we have a class in here where what's D? Where D is the expected dimension. So this is expected complex dimension. Of NV and scale. And I want to give you the formula. It comes from an easy application of Riemann-Roch once you understand what the tangent space to Vn is. And the formula is D is equal to the number of marked points, because we already always have varied marked points freely, so that will always give you n dimensions worth of moduli. And then we have the dimension x minus 3 times 1 minus the genus plus the integral over the class beta of the first Cairn class of the manifold of x. Okay, so I'm not going to derive this for you. This is the comes from application of Riemann-Roch, as I said, and is the expected dimension. So in the nicest possible situation, MgNx beta would be a smooth object, a non-singular object, of the correct dimension, and this would just be the ordinary fundamental class of that object. But of course, it might be singular, but of the right dimension, and then you have to worry about how you define the fundamental class. This gives you something. Or it might be too high dimension, in which case it still gives you a fundamental class, kind of the expected degree. So this is very important. This is a standard problem in any kind of enumerative geometry context. You're trying to count something. You write down the moduli space of the objects you're trying to count. You typically, if you're trying to count something, you want it to be finite. Well, what if your moduli space is actually higher than zero-dimensional? Then you have to somehow interpret that, give it some interpretations of finite number anyway. And there are usually various tricks. So there's some very hard work there. This is a very effective Li Tian in defining this, and I'm certainly not going to do it in detail. That's done, and it won't really be relevant for our talks. Okay, so that's the moduli space. And you know, in some sense, what the rest of my talks are really going to be about are not the invariants that we get out of these moduli spaces, but just the trying to understand these moduli spaces themselves. But still, I want to give you some historical background. These were all introduced and really count some numbers. So let me show you how to extract numbers from this in general. So suppose that we're in this situation, x is an oscillator projective. We have a bunch of evaluation maps. So E eval I. Will be a map of MgN x beta to x. What this does is it takes the class of a stable map. I'll put that in brackets, just indicates the point in this moduli space corresponding to the stable map. And you just take this to the point of x given by evaluating f at the point x on it. So we have a whole bunch of maps. We have n maps from space of x. And now you can take, let's take a bunch of tall homology classes. data. So notice that all the data here is encoded. We have n entries, that's going to give us the number of marked points. The genus is down there, class is there. And this will be the integral over the virtual fundamental class, nvn x theta vert, of the cup product. We just pull back mass cohomology classes. By the evaluation maps, this gives us classes in on nvn x beta, and we take the cup product, so this will live in H summation di of the nx beta. So that's the degree. And then this is an element of homology. As long as this is 2D, this makes sense. We're just reading off the rectangle with this element of homology. So this is non-zero, provided the sum of the DIs is 2D. So that gives us a way of extracting numbers. Morally, what does this mean? This is equal to, I'll put equal very big quotes. This is, you should think of this as curves of genus G and class beta passing through subvarieties of X representing the classes. Alpha 1 through alpha N, so point for a dual to alpha 1 through alpha N. Okay, so let's come down to Earth and look at some very explicit examples, which you have all known since how many lines are there through 2 points in the plane? Okay, no one's better than third grade. One. So how do we encode that question here? So we take x equals p2, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to think about the moduli space of genus zero curves, because the line is genus zero, with 2 points. With target space P2 and class being the class of the line at degree 1. We can do a little dimension count, first of all, so as a sanity check. First of all, what do you need to do to specify such a thing? Well, you specify the image, which is a line, and you have to specify 2 points on the line. So, of course, there's a two-dimensional family of lines, and then you have two additional dimensions from the choice of the points. So the dimension should be 4. Let's just check that. That's 2 plus 2 minus 3 times 1 minus 0, and C1 of P2 is 3 times the class of the lines. It's plus 3. That works. So this is the expected dimension. In fact, it's non-singular. Let me alert you, though, that as to what these, because I want to get you used to thinking about stable maps, you can't really think about these things as just a line in the plane with 2 points. Why not? Because the 2 points might come together. What happens when they come together? Well, remember, I said this moduli space is supposed to be proper, so something happens, but the 2 points aren't allowed to coincide. So what happens is that in the moduli space, you have another type of curve. You have a curve that has two components, one of which the map to P2 just identifies with a line. So this will be a straight line. the other one will be contracted by the map. Okay, so we really have to think about this as a stable map. We lose, once the two points come together, we lose the ability to think about this as just a curve sitting inside U2. So this is inevitable. There's nothing we can do about this. And then notice that this is stable because it's a genus zero complement with three special points. That's what this Monterey space looks like. It's very simple. It's four-dimensional. And now we want to say, well, let's try to understand lines that pass through two points. So that is going to be the Groen-Witten variant, which I can write like this. I take the point grade rule classical point. Right here, this is an element of H over 4 of P2. That's the generator of H over 4. And so the way to think about this is, I can think of it cohomologically. That's somewhat hard to think about because I have to understand the cohomology reading of MGNX beta in this case and then do this cup product. But I can think about it much more effectively by just saying, well, what this really means is I fix two general points in P2 and I try to find a line with two marked points mapping to it. And there's obviously just one choice. So we could go on, for example. I could ask the same thing about conics. How do I do that? Well, the space of conics is five-dimensional, so I should impose five more conditions. I got zero this time, two times the classical line. So I'm selecting 5 points, and I'm asking the number of conics passing. 5 points, and that's easy again. There's precisely one. Again, we can think of this as demanding that you pass through, a conic pass through 1 point is a linear condition. You're just taking the general conic that has six coefficients, setting the x and y, setting the variables to be some fixed value as you pass through the point. You get a linear equation. So you impose 5 conditions, you get 1. So then you can go on, and then life gets somewhat more complicated. I want to mention this partly because in a future lecture I'm going to come back to this example. You can go to genus, degree 3. This time you have to take 8. And this is now somewhat non-trivial, because I can't just think in terms of the equation of a cubic, plane cubic, because that will be genus 1, not 0. The genus 0 plane cubics will be images, but the things that we want to really consider are maps from P1 into P2, whose images degree 3, and will be thus some kind of Noether curve, cusp curve. And it turns out, so if you fix 8 points, it's kind of a fairly standard fact in algebraic geometry. First of all, there's a pencil, so a P1 worth of knots of cubics passing through it. You just fix the, if you don't demand that it be a singular cubic, you have a P1 worth of cubics. That then gives you, after you blow up these 8 points, you actually have to blow up a 9th point because there will be an unexpected base point in that family. You blow up these 9 points and get a rational elliptic surface whose fibers are these cubic curves, and then use the general fact that the Euler characteristic of such a surface is 12, and therefore there should be, you expect 12 singular fibers. And that turns out to be the right answer. So any way you come up with number 12, you get the right answer. And you can go on, think next number, 640, it gets harder and harder to if I was giving you different series of lectures, I would show you how you can use wind theory to define something called quantum cohomology, which is associative, and from associativity follows all these numbers. And in general, there's a lot of structure to go with wind invariants, which is what makes them interesting and what makes them meaningful in many instances to the computable. So I want to do just a few other examples of moduli spaces, just to show you that this issue about the virtual dimension, the need for a virtual fundamental class, is very basic. It's not a very obscure situation where the dimension is incorrect. So let me leave this dimension problem up here for a minute. So here I've been talking about the stable maps to P2 of genus 0. And instead, let's take a look at M1, so genus 1, 0, P2. And this time, representing the classical line. Now, the very first time you see this, you think, I'm trying to trap it. This is empty because there's no degree 1 map from an elliptic curve to P2. However, it's not empty, and that's because there are some interesting stable maps. So what you do is you take a stable line and attach another component. So this will be our domain. It will be a P1 connected to an elliptic curve. And then you map it into P2 by mapping this to a line, and then this the map is constant. Genus 1 component. Okay, so this is, you have to admit, is not really capturing anything about elliptic curves in P2, but from the way it defines moduli space, you really do have to consider these things. And then let's do a little dimension math. What's the dimension of this? Well, you have the choice of a line, that's two dimensions. You have the location to where you glued on this elliptic curve, that's an extra dimension. And then you have the modulus of the elliptic curve. There's a one parameter amount of elliptic curves. So this is four dimensional. And let's just check the expected dimension is no mark points here, zero. 1 minus g is zero, so that term disappears. And then the classical line dot the anti-canonical class. Okay, so already in a very simple situation, the dimension is wrong. Unfortunately, in this case, for rather stupid reasons, but nevertheless, it's wrong. So there's one example where you have to live with the dimension being wrong. Another kind of the very first case is the situation that led to the invention of wind invariants. This whole story, I didn't start very historically in this discussion, the whole story started with trying to understand counting curves and Clausius threefolds, for example, threefold. So if X is a Clausius threefold, so i.e. non-singular projective, the quintic hypersurface of P4, then it is easy, and in particular for the thick, a general thick in P4, it's easy to find maps from P1 into X. I won't say it's easy, but there are plenty of them. Maps from P1 to X. And actually, in this case, what is the expected dimension? Dim X is 3, so this term disappears. I'm not marking any points. And C1 is 0, so expected dimension is 0. And indeed, if this map is such that this is injective with the or embedding, close embedding. Normal bundle O of minus 1 plus O of minus 1, then we're in a very happy situation. The Monjoie space, at least locally near this curve, is just a point. It's a non-singular point. It counts for one curve. So this will be an isolated point in Monjoie. So, you know, it was kind of expected when people start thinking about the quintic. Well, this is the kind of thing we want to be counting. If you choose a generic quintic, then probably we're okay. That's still not known. We're probably okay. We just are counting curves like this. Each such curve counts once. End of story. But you immediately run into trouble because the moment you have one of these curves, you have lots of examples of curves of stable maps where the Monjoie space is too big. Why is that? You just take multiple covers of this curve. So you just take compositions. You take compositions, P1 to P1. This will just be some D to 1 cover, of which there are many. It will have to be branched, of course, followed by F. In general, there's a d-dimensional Monjoie space in these covers, and you know exactly what the Monjoie space is. It doesn't depend on anything on this map. D minus one dimensional. It's positive dimensional. it's not d because the one's one to one, which is zero dimensional. And you have to use the virtual fundamental class to calculate the contribution to the Gödel invariants for these curves. And this contributes the Gödel invariant 1 over d cubed, which is a famous early calculation. And in fact, in the original physics paper that did mirror symmetry and calculated the numbers of the quintic, they just made this guess that this was the So this issue about the virtual fundamental class and the expected dimension not being the right dimension is something fundamental throughout the theory, so you really do need to come to terms with that.
Or in your formula, you take any genus you want because it just drops out.
Right? That's right, and in a Clavier threefold case, you expect it to be rigid. Okay, so anyway, that's what I want to say about as I say, we're not going to really care about this series of lectures. We're not really going to care about numbers at all. I will return to this particular example a couple of lectures from now to count this in a slightly harder way. You don't challenge yourself unless you do things in a harder way. And that's a good one. Research. First, do easy things in hard ways so you learn something. Okay, so that's the end of the first section. So any questions? Anything you always want to know about or wouldn't be afraid to ask? I probably can't answer.
I was a bit confused with the virtual dimensions here. It looked like the dimensions were symmetrically going up by 3 each time. Back when you were doing the 2 times the line, the 3 times the line, just before that.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, they're going up by 3 each time, right? But then 2 times that's going up by 6 each time.
So let's see. We have to.
So 2D is going up by 6 each time. You add, you go a higher degree for P2, right?
Yes, so let's do these.
But then you're trying to add a degree 4 condition each time.
Okay, so let me do the calculation on the board, otherwise I'll get it wrong. So here we have, this is just minus 1. So we have a dimension is n, where we haven't yet determined n, n plus n minus 1, rather. want to impose n conditions. So if we're going to have n marked points, we want to impose n conditions. So we're going to have a condition that 4n is equal to that. So I think that's probably it. Right? So then you cancel out. It's probably this n. So they can cancel the n. You have 3n. I need a 2 here, right? I'm getting confused. It's because I was inconsistent in my conventions about whether I put a 2 or not. Right, this is, was I put a 2, this is the real dimension. 4 is the real dimension. So then I'm just going to put 2, and then I get n is equal to 3d minus 1. So I need 3d minus 1 points. When am I supposed to stop?
You start at 5, so go 6.
Okay, so let's move on to section 2. So this is, everything I talked about here is very last millennium prehistory. Now we're going to move to the first decade of this millennium. So I'm going to talk about relative width inference. And I'm going to be considerably sketchier at this stage because this is just intended probably to motivate what I'm going to do next. Whereas this general picture we're going to be coming back to frequently. So the basic idea, so this showed up in two people's works, Lee Ron, one hand, and Ian L. Parker, on the other, roughly 2001. So the idea is to try to find a new tool for doing Gore-Witten calculations. And the basic idea is very simple. Suppose we have a non-singular variety. I did kind of hint at this, that this was a symplectic construction, but maybe I should have said at this point, we'll just have a remark, which really belongs here, which is that Gore-Witten invariance. Now, the way I've defined them, or the way I'm outlining the definition, is defined inside the context of algebraic geometry, but the basic fact is that it only depends on what is a projective variety X to projective, it comes in the Kähler form, it's a symplectic form, and it only depends on the symplectic. So if you deform the variety X in a flat deformation, you don't change the invariance. That's a very important axiom to go with here. So let's try to understand Gore-Witten invariance by degenerating our variety. So if it's the invariance stay constant in the family, we can try to be a bit more radical and take the family where X actually. Let's consider something like this, x to b, where b is a one-dimensional state, which is a curve. Come on, a good example. And we'll have some special points, or if you're like complex geometry, take a disk. You have some special point b, 0 in b, 5 x, 4, taking x. And we want xb to be singular for b non-zero, and then we're going to allow this to, so this is a flat family. We're going to allow x0 to be singular, but in a relatively simple way. What we're going to insist is the normal crossing is union of two varieties, so the normal crossing. divisor in total space X. Now I use the notation D. So D will be divisor inside Y1 and the plot 2. So the picture is we have B down here, 0. In general, we just have some nice non-singular variety, the plot, and then over 0, it breaks up into two pieces. Those two pieces meet transversely along the divisor in D. Okay. And then, if we're lucky, maybe you can define Grom-Widenbrand for this central fiber. And then, if we're even luckier, we can define them in a way that's then invariant under deformation. So we can do a calculation here rather than doing it here. Why would we like to do that? Well, because often you can break this very complicated variety up into two simpler varieties where you can understand the Grom-Widenbrand. So the key point in trying to define these is if you think a little bit, and I'm not going to go through the details now, but we'll return later on. You try to ask, what kind of curves in here might have a hope of actually deforming to curves over here? So if you just took, for example, a curve like that, that meets the, let's take a simpler example. If you have a curve like that that just avoids D, it's not too hard to convince yourself that this should probably deform. Of course, it may not. There might be some obstructions, but there's no intrinsic obstruction to deform. But if instead I took a curve like that, it's actually not too hard to see that there's no hope of this deforming. So it's a very basic topological obstruction at the singular point. One way to think about this is that topologically, is that when you do this smoothing, well, in general, if you smooth a node, draw a real picture of what's going on. The nearby fiber has a vanishing cycle. You get this singular fiber by contracting the vanishing cycle. So if you have a curve like this, just this component, that's going to kind of blow up to this thing. It will be something with a boundary. That very vague argument, but something with a boundary is not a curve. So we're not going to be allowed to do that. So it's fundamental topological obstruction forming that, but if I pair it up with something on the other side, you can do it. And in fact, the general rule is that if you have a curve over here with some order of tangency to D, and it's paired up on the other side of the curve with the same order of tangency, then there's no local obstruction to smoothing. There might be some global obstruction, but that's always going to happen. I should again point out this deformation invariance of Grom-Widenbrand invariance is not the same thing as deformation invariance of the moduli spaces. The moduli spaces could jump in dimension, all sorts of crazy things could happen. It's the numbers that are invariant. So that led those people to think about, first of all, thinking about the right kind of stable maps to the singular space as being things that have these kind of tangency properties. And then even further say, well, okay, so that means that curves you're interested in over here, if you view them over here, they're going to break up into pieces. Some pieces go here, some pieces go here, but you need to impose this tangency condition. So let me draw a picture, say Y1 and D. And now what we want to do is we want to understand Grom-Widenbrand theory for curves that have marked points with some specified order of tangency along the divisor. So this leads us to relative invariance. And rather than trying to write down a full definition, I'm just going to wave my hands at this a bit. Writing a full definition would require about 14 hours. So idea, work with stable maps along B specified at certain mark points. So a typical example, say, would be you take a line L containing P2, and then you want to count curves in P2 which have one, maybe you're interested in counting plane cubics that are triply tangent to the line at one point. So that seems like a perfectly reasonable thing to do. It's not too hard to understand how to impose such a condition. And then you immediately realize that properness becomes a huge problem. Why does that become a problem? Well, you can imagine a situation, so you have some family of curves. Let me try to draw the visor in red. You know, what can go wrong? Well, maybe there's a family of curves where this curve breaks up in some way, and suddenly one of the components of the curve, or maybe the whole curve, falls into D entirely. What does it mean for a curve falling into D to have order of tangency 3 with D? It seems completely meaningless. I mean, how would you normally define order of tangency? You take a local equation, T equals 0 for D, you pull it back by the morphism, you get some function on the curve, which vanishes to some order, to the point. That's the order of tangency. If T equals 0 pulls back to the 0 function, that doesn't help you. So you have this basic problem of dealing with properness because you have to be aware that these curves can fall into D. And components can fall into D, making it difficult to define order of tangency. So the idea, I think it was originally in the E.N.L. Parker paper, I think it was less visible in the Braun paper, but was then taken much more seriously by Jun Li, who gave an algebraic formulation for these relative invariants, is to use something known as expanded degenerations, or expanded targets. So I'm going to be very vague here. I just want to convince you that this is difficult. And therefore, I want to make sure I present it badly enough to be sure it's difficult. The idea is that we might have to not just, so as the domain degenerates, I'm going to have to degenerate the target too. Right? That's clearly more difficult. So you might have some situation, let's say, draw this as P2 here with a line. We have some curve here, which is degenerating. And then, so in the one parameter family, it degenerates to something which has a component falling into this curve, and now we no longer know what it means and in order 3. Well, what you do is you tack on to the target space, you tack on a P1 bubble. This is the projectivization of, well, depending on your choice of growth and Deke or Fulton convention for projectivization, maybe you do or don't have that dual there. So OD plus the normal bundle of D. So you have you're connected there to the original variety, and then you have a new copy of D over here. So this P1 bubble has two sections, one of which corresponds to OD, one of which corresponds to ND, and dual. And then your new, so here's the new copy of D, the curve now might have, well, in this case, I'm going to do something like that. It will have an extra component which is mapping into this ruled surface. And this time, we do it in such a way that we're not allowed to fall into a new copy of D. you see, we might have this irreducible comp button here, which, if you have forgotten about this, will surface. Just project down here, you would have had comp button falling into the original device. So the thing is that you might have to add more and more of these as you degenerate further. You have to keep very careful track of the target spaces as well as the domain space and families. This is just an absolute hell, and it's very difficult to actually define. I think everyone made a mistake. It's well enough understood now that everyone buys it, but there's a 100-plus page diatribe on the archive about the original papers, which may or may not be justified. It's difficult. So let me then just end. So Jun Li did his work, so the algebraic formulation, which more or less makes this rigorous, I think it's about 2003. And in 2001, after I started working with Baron Siebert, he suggested that really the right way to deal with these issues relative invariants are to use not these crazy expanded degenerations, but to use a tool that originated in non-parametric geometers called log geometry. So the point I'll start by, well, in the next lecture I'll get serious about telling you what this means, and I'll spend quite a lot of time trying to build up some intuitions to what log geometry is about. But the basic idea is that this is a kind of decoration of ordinary geometry, which is really ideally adapted for keeping track of things like orders of tangency, composing things like orders of tangency in such a way that you don't have to worry about all these crazy things like expanded targets. And I should say that, you know, the difficulty, all of this was done just in the case of degenerating a surface in a union of two, or broadly to a union of two dwellings. The difficulty in understanding these expanded targets made it essentially impossible to extend to more complicated degenerations, especially with arbitrary normal crossings degeneration. So this was sort of the fundamental tool for generalizing these ideas, and will allow us to consider degenerations that are even much more general than normal crossings. So I'll start next time with just a very down-to-earth introduction to log geometry.